we have. Thank you. We have the second keynote presentation. And you all had the article last night on the point of gravity by Lynn Smolin, one of the researchers here. So what we have is some people touch on that, not exclusively on that theory, but in the same general area. And we have Dr. Simone Speziali, and he is one of our post-doctoral researchers here at Perimeter Institute. We're very lucky to have him all the way from Rome, Italy, where he was born and grew up. He did a PhD at La Sapienza University in Rome and Cambridge University as well in the area of quantum gravity that we'll be talking about. And he came here, I think it was 9 months ago, to PI to start a postdoc. And he works in the area of quantum gravity and spin foams. And we'll be talking about that today. And apparently he tells me that his team won some little soccer tournament. I was not really sure about the details.
Thank you.
So, can you hear me? Because I'm still recovering my voice. So today we'll introduce you to the field of research known as quantum gravity. The field of research which here at PI is very strong, but I have to tell you that it's very little as compared with the rest of theoretical physics. So instead of being very little, it's actually usually very attractive to describe, and especially students, high school students, as the one you talk to might feel very attractive to this kind of things, because they really, in some situations, they really look like watching a science fiction movie because of all the crazy ideas that come. Precisely for this reason, it is very important, I think, to separate what are the, let's say, the real results, what are the facts, and what are just hypotheses and ideas. So my idea for the talk is to give you an introduction to what are the problematics of this field of research. What are people trying to understand, and what are the possible solutions that so far have appeared. So, you all know that the 20th century has brought us two major revolutions in our concept of the world. These two beautiful theories, known as general relativity and quantum mechanics, have changed the large-scale picture which we had, as well as the microscopical features which we had before in the 19th century and previously. So it is usually said, however, that the domain of application of these two theories is very different. In fact, the general relativity, on the one side, is the theory of gravity proposed by Einstein to, in a sense, to replace Newton's theory, but more than to replace it, to actually give corrections to it. So it is not the case that Newton's theory is wrong, it's just that Newton's theory is correct only to a certain amount of energy involved. When the energies involved are higher, you need corrections to this theory, and the corrections are provided by Einstein's theory. So the theory, since when it was first written in 1916, it gave an amazing amount of predictions which were experimentally confirmed, and it is one of the strongest theory that we have at the moment for physics, because of the amount of checks that the theory has sustained. But the same kind of argument applies just as well for quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics was developed more or less at the same time with a completely domain of application. So general relativity was applying to microscopic, to big objects like stars, like the solar system and galaxies, whereas quantum mechanics was applied to the microscopic world of the atomic structure and the subatomic structure. And possibly it's even better experimentally verified. So we have these two theories which are extremely precise, both are extremely beautiful, they address completely different worlds in principle. However, their domain of application is so wide that in principle there are places where you can find them, let's say, they should be talking to each other. And just to give you an idea of how the domain of applications could come to us, when you speak about general relativity, you always think about stars, galaxies, but actually, I suppose you've seen one of these things, it's a global positioning system, a GPS. Actually, this object, in order to work, needs the corrections from general relativity in a very subtle way. So this tells you precisely your position on the planet. To do so, it has, I think, four satellites that pinpoint your position. Now, the funny thing is that the satellites are in general in different gravitational fields because they are in different places of the Earth. And one of the striking, one of the amazing features of general relativity is that time is felt differently by clocks which live in different gravitational wave wells. Now, if you know a little bit of special relativity, you already know that time is felt different by clocks which move with different speed. And you probably have seen this very famous expression that the time for an observer, so the time for a two observer related by a velocity v is not the same, but it's something like that. This is called the time dilation from special relativity. It's a very famous expression. It tells you that if you move with different velocity, you feel time differently. The next step provided by general relativity was that also if you live in different gravitational wells, you feel time differently. So these clocks living on the satellites, in order to be synchronized, need to take into account these corrections. And if you don't, the very good sensitivity of this object, which can give you a position up to a few meters, gets a correction, gets an error, and it's like tens of meters. So it is really there, reasonably. On the other hand, quantum mechanics, which is the theory of very small things, it's actually responsible for the fact that nebulas have colors. Why? Well, because you know that you have the layers structure of the atomic levels. So that when you excite an atom, you're only allowed a certain gaps in the energy levels. So basically what happens is that suppose you have a huge hydrogen cloud and you have some star behind it. So the light coming from the star excites the hydrogen atoms which you have in your cloud, and when the electrons come back, they do it using the rules of quantum mechanics, and the steps that they can take are quantized, and so the amount of energy that can be released, it's usually always the same, and in this case it corresponds to red when it's the Lyman series. This is for the hydrogen atom, or different colors, because of course the amount of energy is related to the edge, to the length, to the wavelength, and so to the color of light. So when you see red nebulas, it's pretty often the case that that's just a hydrogen cloud that has been excited along the Lyman series. So the two theories seem to start overlapping already in, let's say, normal regions of our universe. However, we have more need for a unified theory when we go and try to describe what are the most extreme behavior in the universe, which are the behaviors in the black holes or for the Big Bang singularities. So there is a desire to actually merge the two theories, and this is the research for the theory of quantum gravity, merging them. In order to understand why it's hard to merge the two theories, to put together their basic principles, I should tell you something about what are the key aspects of the two theories and how much they are in contradiction and why it is so hard. So the obvious thing to say about general relativity is that it describes gravity as the manifestation of the curvature of space-time. Let me give you an example to describe this better. Suppose you have two particles, which are two little tiny balls, which just roll on a table, on an horizontal table. They're free. So they just have initial speeds, and suppose they are parallel. So they will move parallel to each other. So free particles move along parallel lines. Now suppose that the two particles are charged, for instance. So one is positive and the other, and the other one is negative. So that there is a force attracting them. They don't move anymore along parallel lines, but they will tend to go to one toward the other, and in the end they will crash at some point. But now suppose that they are doing the same experiments and these two balls are rolling not on a table but are rolling on a bigger ball. So you have a bigger ball like that, and let's say you start from the equator with your two balls and they move parallel towards the north. You have no forces now, so you're moving along parallel lines. But still, because the Earth is round, in spite of moving along parallel lines, they will crash at the North Pole. So free particles on the plane never touch, but free particles on a sphere will touch. So free particles on a sphere will look like interactive particles on a plane. So that's more or less the idea. So for electromagnetism, this doesn't quite work. But what Einstein found out was that when the force of attraction is actually gravity, you can always find a curved space such that the free motion, so the motion along parallel lines or geodesics, is exactly the same that you have on a flat space, but with the inclusion of the gravitational force. So that's why, and because this equivalence always applies for gravity, that's why we say that gravity is described as a manifestation of the curvature of space. Okay. You might wonder if really one can push this analogy for electromagnetism. And in fact, the idea, Einstein's idea, was so appealing that immediately afterwards, like in 1917, a German physicist, Kaluza, proposed to describe also the, at the time, the only two forces known were the electromagnetic force and the gravitational force. So he proposed to describe in the very same way also the electromagnetic force by adding a fifth dimension and saying that this doesn't quite work for ordinary space-time. But he proposed that the attraction, the electromagnetic attraction, could be explained adding a fifth dimension and describing it as the curvature of this fifth dimension. This idea seemed crazy at the time, but somehow it has survived. And there's still loads of physicists that are trying to work on these ideas of extra dimensions along the same path that taken by Kaluza 2 years after this. So this is the idea, the key idea of general relativity, that when you add matter, and matter interacts because of gravity, you can describe it as you just curve the space-time. What is now, I should also mention, of course, that this very simple idea then brings to the most exciting things that we usually describe when we talk about physics, and possibly the nicest of all is the black hole. Now, it's nice to say that actually the black hole was hypothesized by Laplace in 1795, because he simply observed that the concept of escape velocity. So if you have, let's say you're on a planet of radius r and mass m, and you want to escape from the gravitational attraction of this planet, the velocity which you get the escape. The escape velocity which you need to escape this planet using Newtonian mechanics can be written as simply like this. And Laplace observed that if the speed of light is actually finite, so there's a certain amount of, it's finite, it's not infinite, then you can find objects which are massive enough or small enough such that not even light can escape them. And these objects will really be black. So the idea was there since a long time before, I have to say. But then the interpretation which we now have, the understanding, is much more trickier. So you know what a light cone is. So basically, a light cone tells you your causal structure. So it tells you which direction you can move in space-time. So consider a diagram like this with space and time. If you're still, you move like this. If you're moving at a certain velocity, the higher the velocity, the smaller this angle. But because of special relativity, we know that the highest velocity that can ever be reached is the velocity of light. So there's actually a maximum cone which is allowed for us to move. So if you use this interpretation in order to describe the physics around the black hole, what you find is that when you reach a particular surface, so out of the surface you are able to move towards the surface or far away. But once you reach that surface, you're only allowed to move inside, towards the central point. Mathematically, the way this happens is very simple and very appealing, because I was telling you that in special relativity, time can rescale like that. In general relativity, you can do more complicated things, and time and coordinates can complete, and spatial coordinates can completely get mixed up. So what happens on the event horizon of a black hole is that the time coordinate and the radius coordinate swap their roles. So time is the thing that it's always forced to evolve in one direction, and the radius is the thing that you can change by deciding where to move. But once you've passed this, time becomes the free coordinate that you're allowed to go in one direction or in the other one, whereas the radius becomes the coordinate that is obliged to evolve in only one direction, and the direction it evolves is towards the center. So that's the way that it is.
Inside the event horizon, forward and backward in time is not really a problem.
Exactly. Because time, what you call time from outside, is just like a radial coordinate. It's like this coordinate. So you can decide to go there, to there. Okay? That's why the physics inside the event horizon is not particularly clear to us, and it's not even particularly clear to us how well this is accessible. Okay? Because the evidence we have of black holes is of the event horizon itself, not of what's inside, because nothing can come out. And this has given rise to many fancy-looking pictures like this, where you have these circles gives you an idea of how space-time is getting the more and more curved towards the... So somewhere here is the event horizon, and then you get inside. And this is a jet, which is seen because when matter spirals around these things, then you have electromagnetic friction, and so you have a release of energy like that. Actually, this is just an artist's impression. More realistic pictures will look like that, where you can see the what is called the accretion disk, and then the inside, in the most internal part of the black hole there, which is, of course, just the event horizon. We don't see anything inside. Now, the black hole, as I said, the black hole is, of course, the most sci-fi object that we can ever imagine, and we have lots of movies and crazy books about it. But actually, it's very easy to realize a black hole in any room, or maybe in a bathroom, in a place where you don't have problems with water overfilling. Let me give you an example. Consider this little waterfall. And let's focus on the part before the waterfall. So suppose I drop a little stone there. I get waves propagating over in all directions, okay? But the more I get close to the waterfall, the more the waves will be suppressed if they tend to go in this direction, whereas they'd be okay going in that direction. Until you reach a point where you are very, very close to the edge, where even though you are perturbing the water there, you don't see any wave propagating back, because the attraction from the waterfall is so strong. You can realize this very easily by having a bucket and making it overfill and then going with your finger like this. And usually students are trying it. They go like, whoa. And it's very efficient. And this is really, and so the surface of the water is the event horizon for the waves that propagate over the surface of the water. Whereas the event horizon of a black hole makes the same thing for light. So these are basically the basic aspects of general relativity, this curvature of space-time, this dynamicity of space-time. Now, what are the basic aspects of quantum theory? Completely different, of course. So the basic principle of general relativity was the uncertainty principle, the equivalence principle, that idea. The basic principle of quantum mechanics is the uncertainty principle, which Heisenberg stated as the exact position and momentum of a particle cannot be known simultaneously. Now, you know that the consequences of this is that trajectory becomes fuzzy because, of course, because of course, if you want to reconstruct the trajectory of a particle, you need, for each point, you need to know what's the position and what's the velocity at that point. That's the only way you can reconstruct the particle's trajectory in a deterministic way, as in usual classical mechanics. But if the two cannot be known at the same time, if I tell you precisely where I am, I cannot tell you really the direction I'm going to, so you don't really know what is the shape of your trajectory. Feynman proposed a very nice way to describe this by saying that actually when you move from a point A to a point B, classically, you would move along the solute trajectory, which is the solution of the equations of motion, and which in here I've drawn as this thick line. But quantum mechanically, you can imagine that you, in principle, can move along any trajectory with a different probability amplitude. So that at the end of the day, your position is not determined fully, but it's just determined with a certain amplitude. In particular, what I would need for the following is that when two variables have these, when two observables satisfy this uncertainty principle, they are called incompatible. The better you know the one, the worse you know the other one. So the other important thing or consequence of quantum mechanics is that we learn the fact that things tend to come in packets or quanta. So one example, of course, is the atomic structure. There was this long-standing problem understanding what was the structure of an atom, and then Bohr came up with this idea that it really looks like the solar system, except that a planet in the solar system can be wherever he wants, as far or as close as possible from the sun, whereas when it comes to atoms, the electrons are only allowed certain fixed radiuses. And that's the spectrum I was giving before. There's also a very another nice example, which is probably the most famous experiment of quantum mechanics, and it's called the Stern-Gerlach experiment. And this has to do with the spin of electrons. So just as well as planets can be wherever they want, far from the sun, they can also spin more or less at the velocity they want. Like the day on Earth is different from the day of Mars. But for subatomic particles, that is not quite the case. So that the electron in particular can only spin, and actually not, this is not true only for the electron, but for most of subatomic particles, they behave in the very same way. They can only spin at a certain angular velocity, either in one direction or in the other one. But the velocity is fixed. And this gives rise to the Stern-Gerlach experiment that if you send a charged particle through a magnetic field, in principle, this will bend accordingly to a fixed magnetic field, it will bend accordingly to the charge of the particle. And it will bend in one direction if it's positive, in the other one if it's negative. So if you do this with classical particles, you will have a distribution there, depending on the kind of charge you're having there. But if you put electrons, you can only get these two spots. Because as I was saying, the electron can only spin like this or like that. There's no other way. And this experiment in 21, 22, I think, it was one of the most important to develop all the tools of quantum mechanics. So what we are learning is that general relativity tells us that space-time is dynamic. So depending on what matter you put on, this is a dynamic field. It's going to change. And quantum theory is going to tell us that all dynamical quantities are quantized, so they obey the uncertainty principle, and they tend to come in quanta. So this leads us to the question, what could quantum space-time be like? So what could the quanta of space look like? So I just told you that gravity is just a manifestation of the curvature of space. So the quanta of the gravitational force are quanta of curvature of space-time. So they are, in some way, the grains of space. So the way space is curvedly built up together. But how can we, have grains of space and then not feel that? Because there's no doubt that all experimental evidence we have is for a smooth space, smooth and continuous. There's a very nice and appealing example that I can give you is that you can consider a nice beach like this, and it looks smooth and very white and beautiful. But of course, if you look at it close enough, then you start to see the grains. So that's more or less the idea, except that in our case, the grains are expected to be at the Planck length, which is something extraordinarily small, like 10 to the minus 13. The smallest thing we can check on our experiments is something of the order of 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 16. So this is way below what we can actually see with our experiments. So what can we know? There's no direct experiments that we can try to test what are the quanta of space-time. And so far, we have no indirect evidence. So this is where I think one has to be very clear that what I've said so far are things related separately to general relativity and to quantum mechanics. They are very experimentally verified. They are very nice theories. We understand them. Now we are moving to a different domain where we have no experiments leading us. In a way, we are lost in the dark, and our search is a pure theoretical quest. So this is very important to stress, because it means that what I'm going to talk about, and what you usually hear when you hear about quantum gravity, is not facts, is not a verified physics, is ideas, is hypotheses, which were invented by the researchers and which have good chances or less chances of being verified. The thing that you have to bear in mind is that this search has been pursued for 70 years, and there's been yet no theory which is at the same time consistent and makes sense of the predictions. There are two major approaches at the moment. One is the approach known as string theory that stems from a particle physics point of view. And the other one, much smaller, is the loop quantum gravity approach, which comes from a general heuristic point of view. To give you the idea, I think that the string people are about a few thousand, like 3,000 or 4,000. The loop quantum gravity people are about a couple of hundreds. And there's a bunch of other ideas, which, of course, the number of people working on it are even smaller. But my opinion is that because there are, experimental evidence, all these ideas have to be considered.
Is there evidence that space is not smooth? Have you come that far?
So yes. So the one that I was giving was a picture from when we're trying to push these ideas. Space time is dynamical. Dynamical quantities are discrete. Trying to push that idea. But of course, once you have an idea, then you should verify it experimentally, which is, I don't know who's first, but
yeah. Oh yeah, no. So since you're doing loop quantum gravity, do you think string theory is correct?
Is what?
Do you think string theory is correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, I have a slide on string theory, the next one. So I think string theory is beautiful. What I think of string theory is that it's the dark side.
You mastered my question.
Why? Because remember the movie. Because it's very tempting and it's very powerful. Precisely like the dark side. So what do I mean? Very tempting because, oh, maybe, can I have that related? No.
Maybe later you can talk about this.
So very tempting, why? Because it follows a path, the path of particle physics, which has been amazingly beautiful, elegant, and successful since it was born in the 20s until 74. Oh, 74 is a very precise date. 74, the standard model, the Weinberg model, was written. After that day, not a single prediction of particle physicists has been either verified, has been verified and is not correct, or is not verifiable. So we really have a very sharp moment in the history of theoretical physics when all of a sudden our theories seem to be perfectly correct. Until that point, every time we tried to push them further, we were either wrong or in the dark because we could have no experimental confirmation. And this is the path that has given us all this beautiful picture where you see that the matter is described in terms of six quarks and six leptons, and then you have the interaction bosons to describe forces. So it is a really powerful, a really beautiful picture. And the approach is very powerful because of all the experience that's been accumulated and because of all the mathematical tools that are handy in that case. In particular, what I find very interesting of the theory is that it's a theory that is trying to give a unified description of matter and interaction, even though I'd like to spend a few minutes, a little bracket on this. So, because there's beautiful steps in trying to unify things and less beautiful steps. So when, in the early 50s, the conception of the world was in terms of three, In the prehistoric times, we only had the proton and the neutron, right? In our understanding in the 20s. But then it came about that there was an inside structure to these things, and the quarks were underlying these objects, in particular up, up, down, and up, down, down quirks. And we seemed to be able to describe matter in terms of two quarks. But the point was that in the 50s, we had an amazing amount of particles, a zoo of particles, which was very hard to understand and give a precise picture of what was the relation of these particles with the proton and the neutron. Things were very confused. And then Gell-Mann, among the others, proposed that if you add a third quark, so instead of only having up and down, you include another quark, which people were a bit, I'm going to say, confused about. So it was called the strange quark. You could describe all these zoo of particles in very, very simple ways, as in all the couples that you could build up out of the three quarks, or all the triplets that you could build up. So this was called the eightfold wave, and it was really beautiful that this worked. The funny thing is that there was a symmetry underlying this approach, which was called the SU3 symmetry. Then when the fourth quark was discovered, people were trying to push the same idea further. So now let's suppose we have an SU4 symmetry. And it turns out this is wrong. So a beautiful idea, a beautiful symmetrical idea, is not always meant to be correct. And this is one of the slightest examples we have where trying to extend the idea of symmetry led us to a wrong result. So the idea of unifying is beautiful in itself, but it has to be taken cum grano salis, the Latin used to say. So people have to be careful about it. So one thing that often is suggested as a beautiful symmetry underlying our universe is called the supersymmetry, or SUSY. And I suppose all of you have heard about it. So the initial idea was that, so then you have the six quarks, the six leptons, and then you have the interacting bosons. So the idea was that maybe these are just, all these particles are just a reflection one of the other. And there's actually a symmetry that is relating them just as well as there's a symmetry relating the proton and the neutron. So it's enough that you swap one up quark with one down quark in order to relate them. This was the initial idea. And supersymmetry seemed to be an answer to that, except that it's the wrong answer, in the sense that instead of relating this particle among each other, you relate each one of these particles with a twin, which we haven't seen yet. So it doubles the number of particles that we see. So it is really a beautiful idea, and it has lots of attractive consequences. But as far as the initial idea is concerned, it's not really answering it. So this is one of the most important aspects of string theory. The other very important aspect is the extra dimensions, which are needed to make the theory consistent. And these are very much related to the ideas of the Kaluza guide that I was telling to you before. So you can imagine that the curvature of the extra dimension is affecting the dynamics in the four dimensions we live in. However, the theory, in spite of being so powerful and so appealing so far, has not produced testable predictions. But moreover, the reason why I'm not going to focus on this is that it doesn't really directly address the question of what are the grains of space, what are the quanta of space-time. It's more, as I was saying, more concerned with the idea of unifying the forces, the other forces, so the weak force, the strong force, and the electromagnetic force, with the matter content of the universe. So since string theory is the dark side, let me go now to the bright side. And I will try to describe you what this other approach looks like. So this other approach called loop quantum gravity, and you will see soon why the word loop is in the title. So just as well as string theory and as many other approaches which I was mentioning to you earlier, it's a candidate description. All these ideas are just hypotheses and are just candidate theories as long as we don't have direct or indirect confirmations of their predictions. So this theory does describe a theory of quantum space-time. And what are the quantum space-time? So imagine you have a little region, for simplicity, a ball in space-time. What this theory tells you is that the area and the area of this surface and the volume of space-time within have a spectrum, which is a discrete spectrum, very much as the hydrogen atom as a discrete spectrum for the energy levels. So, and how is this picture coming about? So first of all, you see that it's a picture of discrete space, because you see now that there's only fixed amount of areas that surfaces can have, and there's only a discrete and fixed amount of volumes that that regions of space-time can have. Of course, these numbers here, 1, 2, 3, are in Planck length units, so these are amazingly small. So it's like saying that even though it's like the picture of the beach I showed you before, the grains that build up the beach are so small that actually when you walk on it, you don't really feel it. So that's why it's so hard to test these kind of theories directly. But how is the theory constructed? So the theory is constructed like this. The main object of the theory is a graph. And imagine, so a graph is a set of nodes with links between the nodes. And imagine you have, inside that region, you have this portion of the graph, which is defining the theory. What happens is that these dots, so the nodes of the graph, carry the quanta of volumes. So counting the number of nodes you have, you can count the volume inside that region, you can count the volume of the region. And counting the number of links which are popping out the surface of that region, you're counting the area of that surface. So this is basically the idea. You don't have any space-time to begin with. You only have this huge graph somewhere there. And then if you want to know what's the distance between one point and the other point, you draw a line, or if you want to know the area, you draw a surface, or if you want to know the volume, you draw the inside of the surface. And then you count how many times you're intersecting the nodes and the links of this graph. And that's what is going to contribute you the volume or the other metrical properties of space-time. This is a very much quantum mechanical picture. Just think about going from the usual wave description of light to the photon description of light, so to the quantum mechanical one. If you want to know the intensity of light, you just count the number of photons you have in, and that gives you your beam. And if you had a flashlight, which you could make dimmer and dimmer, what's going to happen at a certain point is not that the light is going to become dimmer, it's just that if you could, in principle, you would start seeing the individual photons, okay, coming up. Same thing here. If you can reduce the surface you're measuring to a smaller and smaller surface, you're going to start to see the single quantum contribution to the area and volumes and to the geometrical properties. So, yes?
You might end up addressing this later on, but by what mechanism is space quantized such that the smallest part is 10 to the negative 33? Why can't it be smaller?
Well, because this is really a nice exercise of dimensional analysis. And it's the fact that, so we're putting together two theories. One is quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics comes with a constant, which is h bar, which is E is equal to 2 pi h bar mu, Planck's relation. And so this is one. And then we have general relativity. General relativity comes with two constants. One is C, the speed of light, which is inherited from special relativity. And another one is Newton constant, G, which is inherited from the Newtonian theory of gravity. So you have three fundamental constants. These three fundamental constants provide scales for your theory. So if you want, this constant alone is a scale factor for the gravitational attraction. Okay? In fact, you can, for instance, you can compare these with, so you know that, so the Newton's force is G, mm over r squared, and the electromagnetic, the Coulomb force, is E, let's say, or Q, the charge. And then Q1, Q2 over r squared, and then you have, it depends on the unit you use, you have K or 1 over 4 pi epsilon 0. These two constants can be used to compare the strength of the two forces. So they provide a scale for the interaction. And this is extremely smaller than this, which is the reason why gravity is so much weaker than the electromagnetic force, which is the reason why. What was the joke of Wiltshire? Oh, yes, which is the reason why I can jump using my electromagnetic interaction, despite of the all Earth pulling me down, trying to pull me down. So these constants provide scales for your theories. And now when you put all three together, because you want to do a theory which knows about quantum mechanics, knows about special relativity, and knows about gravity, it turns out that you can construct something which has which dimensionally is a length. And this is called the Planck length. So this is a natural scale of your theory of quantum gravity. And when you plug the values of these things, which are experimentally measured, you get 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So that's the origin of this particular scale.
And then is the Planck time a result of the Planck length?
You have the Planck length, you have the Planck mass, the Planck time.
Okay.
You just play around with this. Instead of using this combination, you use other ones, yeah, and you get masses. So the basic object of the theory is this graph. This graph is called, instead of being called simply a graph, but to make it fancier, it's called the spin network. Well, network is obvious, right? Spin is because usually you don't just count the nodes and links, but these nodes and links come with labels. So they are labeled. And usually they are labeled with what we call spin numbers. And that's why it's in general called the spin networks. Anyway, as I was telling you before, there is really no space-time to begin with, but space-time, the metric, and so the space-time structure will be reconstructed in terms of the properties of this graph. One thing that I would like to stress here is that a graph seems to me particularly suitable to treat quantum properties of general relativity. Why? Because at the end of the day, the basic input of general relativity is that physics has to be done in a purely relational way. There's no fixed background whatsoever that you can use to describe your physics. And this is a very old debate that actually historically goes back to Newton, Leibniz, Descartes, and it was a moral philosophical debate at the time, but it's becoming more technical now, and it's one of the things over which the different researchers working on the same ideas are arguing the most. So the idea of describing your physics over some fixed structure that you have, or giving up as far as possible all your background instructions.
When I look at a spin network, it reminds me of my tree theory course in mathematics, how much tree theory gets pulled into quantum loop gravity.
Not very much about tree theory, more about knot theory. Knot theory, because the thing is that you don't really care about the way this graph is displaced. Because as I was telling you, it's not displaced over something. It's just the graph. So if two points are this far or that far, it doesn't really matter. All that matters is the way they are linked to each other, and if there are knots in the way they are linked to each other. So in fact, this is an interesting point that in order to understand these things, we need lots of mathematics coming from knot theory. And actually, knot theory was started to be developed by Lord Kelvin together with a student of his type. And the idea is that he thought, that was in the second half of the 19th century, 1870-something. So it was at the time when people were starting to understand the chemical structure of the atoms. So the Mendeleev table wasn't yet there. And Kelvin's idea was that you could describe the different atoms as different ways that ether was knocked together. So with a very total, with a completely different idea in mind, they started working on knots. And we now work on knots as well because of this reason. But what matters is not the way the places of these nodes and these links, but only the way they're knocked and they're linked together.
I thought his theory was on vortices instead of knots.
I don't know about the vortex. I'm pretty sure that Kite, this student of his, was working following his ideas on trying to characterize the different structures of the atom.
Yeah, because the vortices in fluid dynamics sometimes are conserved in some sense.
Right.
And they are so pretty persistent. And that's why Lord Kelvin would think of everything to be composed of vortices instead. So this is the first time ever I heard that.
Well, he was also considering notes. Yeah, I wonder if that was before or after.
Okay.
Maybe one of the
okay.
two was okay. really wrong and then he
yeah.
went to that
interesting.
One.
Thank you.
So, okay, so that's the basic object of the theory. So, how is the theory now describing our concept of space-time? So it is a purely theoretical description, as I was saying. So we have inputs. The inputs are some equations, which come from general relativity, and some principles, which come from quantum mechanics. Then we put everything together, and we try to see how these quanta are described. The way these quanta are described is using these graphs. And how do we reconstruct, what picture of space-time we reconstruct out of these graphs? So as I was telling you, you count the volume and areas using these graphs. So let me consider a very simple region. It's even simpler than a sphere. Let me consider a pyramid, a tetrahedron of this. So that I can give you a better understanding of what's the description we end up with. So, and let's consider this as the basic atom. So the things that is going to get minimalistic amount of areas and volumes from the theory. So if this object was classical, you know that classically to determine a tetrahedron, a pyramid like that, you need to give 10 numbers, which for instance are the 6 numbers, which for instance are the 6 edge length. Okay, you give me those, and I can construct a single tetrahedron. Now, you remember that I was telling you that in quantum theory there's a concept of incompatible observables. So these are observables that the better you know one, the worse you know the other one. So what happens in this theory is that there are only 5 compatible quantum observables. So the best you can do is to specify 5, which means that the 6th edge length is going to be completely undetermined. Just as well as for a particle, if you know precisely where it is, you know nothing about its direction. So in fact, if you want to reconstruct some kind of semi-classical motion for a quantum particle, you're not going to measure its position, neither its velocity, because you're going to destroy all semi-classical information in this way. You want to construct a semi-classical wave packet, that's the way it's called, namely a state in which neither the momentum, neither the position are known exactly, but they're both known with a minimal uncertainty. If you remember Heisenberg uncertainty relation, that's that's an inequality, and you want to try to minimize this inequality. So at the same time, you try to minimize simultaneously this determination, so that you're going to end up with a path that is just a gross trajectory, more or less. In our picture, because we cannot describe, we cannot measure simultaneously all the classical geometrical quantities, we need to give the same kind of fuzzy picture. Namely, what we can do to try to reconstruct the geometry is to say, I don't know exactly any of those 6 edge lengths in this example, but I know all of them more or less to a certain accuracy, so that I can end up with a picture of fuzzy geometry. Okay? So this is more or less the idea of quantum geometry that comes up of loop quantum gravity. So it is discrete at the Planck scale, and it is incompatible, if you want, it's fuzzy. Okay?
This could be a little bit technical. Originally, I thought we try to quantize space metric, and we do that. And now you end up with 6 classical observables. So I'm still confused because.
Right, sure. Well, the 6 classical observables are because I was really making a very simple tree model of a single tetrahedron. I was forgetting about the whole space time, the metric, just to give an idea of how things work. Let's just imagine that space time is made by a single pyramid. If space time was classical, that pyramid would be completely determined by measuring the edge length. But in my quantum theory, I'm not allowed to do that, just as well as I'm not allowed to measure x and p at the same time in quantum mechanics. So if space time was made out of that, I would not be able to reconstruct it precisely, sharply, but only in a fuzzy way. Of course, the picture becomes just more complicated, but the idea behind it is the same when you consider the whole space time instead of a single block.
Okay. Yes, when you talk about six class of observable, you're referring to the six ages?
For instance, yes. Or you could give areas and angles.
Yeah.
The simplest way is just six ages. So these are the quantum geometry measures from spin networks. Then another word that you've certainly heard of if you hang around here PI for a while is spin folds. So where are spin folds coming from? Spin folds are coming from implementing the dynamics of these spin networks. So I told that the dynamics, I told you that the basic object of the theory are these graphs. Now you know that the dynamical processes are described in classical mechanics, for instance, using Hamilton's equations of motions, and this is the easiest way to implement them in quantum mechanics. In fact, Schrödinger's equation is written in terms of the Hamiltonian. Really, the classical Hamiltonian just treated as a quantum operator. If we try to do the same thing with general relativity, we can write the Hamiltonian of general relativity. This is a very complicated concept, but roughly what we know is that this operator, this Hamiltonian operator, is going to act on the graphs that are describing our theory in this way. It acts on the nodes and it opens them like this. So Damien was telling me that he has given you that article by Lee, and there's a part where he speaks about moves. That's what he means by a move, the action of the evolution operator. When you write your Schrödinger equation, you have I and P of psi, psi is your quantum state, and so the evolution in time is driven by this object here, which is the operator coming from the classical Hamiltonian. What it does, the loop quantum gravity, is a kind of action like this. So, start with a graph. Let's take a very simple graph to start with, like that, much simpler than the one before. It acts on that node, for instance, and it opens up like that, via this action. So if we parameterize this action, it looks like something like this. The initial graph, the nodes, opens up, and a final graph like that. So this is just a graph, but this parameterized action, it looks more like a bunch of surfaces stuck together, because you can see here, it looks more or less like a cylinder. So you have the exterior faces of the cylinder, then you have this inside face, which is a plane more or less like this, and so on. So, more in general, you will get pictures like this, a stack of surfaces put together. And of course, these surfaces, just as well as the spin networks, these surfaces are labeled by numbers, which we call spin numbers, and that's why these things are called spin folds. Well, folds, why? Because that fuzzy idea of space-time emerging from this picture was actually very old and was due to Wheeler. He said the quantum fluctuations at the very macroscopic scale are going to make both the geometry and the topology of space-time fuzzy. And so he used to refer to these as as the space-time form. Because we have spin labels and we call these spin forms. Okay, so what's the physics of this theory? So the basic input, so the basic aspect of the theory is this discreteness of space-time. Of course, this discreteness of space-time, which is purely theoretical, has in principle very strong consequences and very strong implications. Here I mentioned two which are very important. I think there's an E in there, sorry. There you go. So this is one very important point of the theory. So you always hear about the fact that general relativity has problems because it predicts singularities. General relativity breaks down when you try to describe the physics inside a black hole, or when you try to describe physics very close to the Big Bang. What do I mean by breaks down is that the theories start giving you as answers infinite. So not very sensible answers. What you might not be very familiar with is the fact that the same thing is true for quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is plagued with infinities. Almost every question that you ask concerning particle physics, the naive answer from your theory is going to be infinite. So you have to manipulate the theory in a very careful way in order to get to extract sensible answers. So both general relativity and quantum mechanics are plagued by singularities. The fact that the structure of space-time is at a small scale finite, is discrete, has very strong consequences for this. For instance, the inside of a black hole, you have a singularity in the sense that the curvature of space-time becomes infinite towards the center. But of course, if you're only allowed to use small building blocks to construct your curvature, So you can glue them together. There's a fixed amount of, there's a maximum amount of curvature that you can get. The only way to get to a higher amount of curvature is by making your building blocks smaller. So it's like saying that if I put together two pieces of papers, that's the curvature I'm getting. Now, if I use more and a more refined structure, I can get higher curvature in that point. But still, because the building blocks have a smallest size that can be reached, this Planck scale size, there's no way you can get to an infinite curvature. So if really space-time is its microscopic scale is constructed in this way, then there is no problem of singularities inside black holes. Also, the same kind of approach has consequences for particle physics. Most of these infinites of quantum theory come from the fact that you ask questions like, what's the probability for two particles to scatter, to interact? And your mathematical tools require two particles, for two particles to scatter, it is required that they meet in one point. But as I was telling you, so let's say these two particles scatter by meeting in that point. But I was telling you before, quantum particles are not classical, do not follow classical trajectories, but they have a wave distribution. And the wave probability for two different particles of meeting in the same point of space-time is basically zero. So you're asking for an event with zero probability. And that's why your theory has to be very precisely manipulated in order to get sensible answers. If, on the other hand, space-time is discrete at a small scale, then this problem disappears because you don't need any more for two particles to be in the same point. You only need for two particles to meet in the same building block. Remarkably, this is more or less the same kind of solution of this problem that string theory provides. Because string theory says the particles, they are not points. They are actually strings. So you're not having two-point particles collapsing in one point. You're having two strings moving. And they will sooner or later interact in one point. So now the probability is not zero anymore. Here were two points to meet in one point, and now it's two strings. So morally, the same kind of solution is proposed. On the other hand, it is very interesting to see that this picture of discrete space-time, so that was a really purely theoretical approach. So we are trying to solve what are theoretical problems. But this approach has also more phenomenological consequences. Because if space-time is not smooth, it's discrete, maybe there's a way to test it. Direct is very hard, because the structure where space-time is discrete appears at 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. But what happens is that suppose you have a soccer ball rolling around some astroturf, it's going to roll very smoothly if the astroturf is good. But the structure, the fine structure is like this, so if the ball is very small, it will feel it and start bouncing around. How do we make our soccer ball smaller? Because in quantum mechanics tell us that the wave probability of this particle is going to be smaller and smaller, the characteristic wavelength, the higher the energy of the particle. So if we use probes with very high energy, they're going to be sensible to the very small scale of the universe. And this is an idea which could have applications because it could have very small consequences. You're all familiar with the energy law. This law comes from the Lorentz symmetry, which assumes that space-time is Minkowskian, flat, and smooth at all scales. If we now plug in the information that space-time could be discrete on very small scales, we could end up with deformations of this law. So everyone knows this law. What could happen is that there could be additional pieces of this sort. So that very high energy, so the L Planck, as I was saying, is ridiculously small, but very high energy particles could actually produce an alpha Betelgeuse parameters of the model that you are implementing. But very high energy particles could, in principle, see deviations from this law. So the idea that came around the mid-90s was that actually cosmic rays, particles that travel all around the universe with very high energies to hit the Earth on our neutrino or other kind of experiments might be actually sensible to this kind of deviations. So the logic is, suppose I see a cosmic ray which doesn't obey this relation, but obeys a relation like that for some alpha and beta parameter. But then I could say that this is due to the fact that the microscopic or microscopic structure of space-time is discrete. So it would be an indirect verification of this microscopic structure that emerges from loop quantum gravity. Of course, in order to be a prediction of the theory, it's not enough to say that a deformation like this could happen. The theory should also fix the values of this coefficient so that the experiment can check the existence of this relation. To be more precise about that idea, there's something called the GZK threshold. And this is the fact that cosmic rays coming from very far in the universe, if they have very high energy, might scatter with the cosmic microwave background of photons, you know, these photons that fill all the universe, and then experiments like boomerang picture, when you see these pictures of the Big Bang, it means that the universe is filled with these photons. Now, if the cosmic rays have energies which are high enough, then they would interact with these photons and decay, which means that cosmic rays with energies higher than those, that threshold at which this interaction happens, you shouldn't see them because they've interacted. And in fact, the classical prediction is this curve here, and you see this drop. When you go too high in energies, you don't see protons anymore because they all scatter with the photons and lose energies. Well, what happened was that these Japanese guys of Agassa seemed to be seeing something different. So people were very excited. Unfortunately, it turned out there was a problem in their experiment. So then the real data are these ones. So there's no evidence. But this is just to give an example of how easily one can be wrong and how anyway one has to pursue in this direction. So could we live in a discrete space-time? So something where a string network reproduces these grains of space, and then the smooth space-time emerges in the large-scale limit. We don't know it until we have done precise predictions which have been tested either directly or indirectly with experiments. Because to conclude, let me remind you that physics is about experimental facts. And we have a very big experimental evidence in these days, which is the fact that we wonder. Thank you.
He was mentioning high-energy photons that travel faster than lower-energy photons, and that
it'd be really a direct consequence of this. This kind of relation, energy relation, implies the fact that actually the velocity of photons, if you apply this to photons, so no mass, then this implies that the velocity of photons depends on their energy. So it is exactly what him and João Magalhães had in mind. So you change the Lorentz symmetry, which is the thing that tells you that light propagates at the same velocity for every observer, and you get you deform it this way, and you get a wavelength depending or energy depending light speed.
Now, within the community, how much of this is accepted, and how much of this might be considered the dark side?
No, surprisingly, it's hard to say that people would be unhappy of seeing an energy dependence of light speed. It has actually been advocated also for other reasons, like to solve the horizon problem of the Big Bang, which is now sort of what is called the inflation theory. But in the 80s, people were thinking that energy dependent light speed would solve that problem as well, because with higher energy, the light cone would open up, so you wouldn't have the horizon problem. So I would say that, and of course, if the photon has a mass, then of course its light speed is not anymore c, but it's something that depends on its energy. And so also experiments concerning the mass of the photon have been always carried out. And that's something that I would say people will not be very unhappy to hear that and to study that. And in fact, both in the string theory and in quantum gravity community, there's also people working on these kinds of deformations of the basic symmetry of space, the Lorentz.
The Large Hadron Collider energies are still too small there for probing.
Way too small.
And is there any idea of being able to build a device on Earth to be able to do that, or is that beyond our technology at this time? Or?
No. Okay, so the idea is that you don't test these kind of theories using direct experiments, because they will require ridiculously big experiments. The idea is that you use more indirect hints, like this one. So you take part, instead of being yourself to accelerate the particles, you exploit the fact that there are accelerated very high energy particles which have traveled the whole of space-time, the whole of the universe to come to us, and so they have felt possible grayness, discreteness of space-time to come. On the other hand, the LHC should be very good to taste some of the ideas behind string theory, such as supersymmetry. So that idea I was mentioning before, that each particle should now have a twin. Now, the reason why we don't see these twins is the first question. Well, the answer is that we don't see them because it's hard to produce them. Now, hard to produce them in particle physics language means that they have a big mass. So you create things in your accelerators using Einstein's law. So if you want to create something with a high mass, you need something with a high energy. You need to have a very high energy acceleration. However, these cannot be pushed forever, as in we never see them when they are too high. No, in order for the theory to make sense, there's a limit that these twins can have for their masses. So LHC should really be able to actually pin them down, as in seeing them or ruling them out, possibly.
Is there any constants that you know you're looking for, or will you get experimental data and say, oh, these are the constants, or do you actually have a constant for alpha and beta along with your LP, whatever that's called?
So experimentally?
Yeah. Like,
this
no.
doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's never been seen.
Okay, but do you have a value, so if it is seen, theory. That you could go and check?
Oh, no, we don't yet. In fact, I was saying this is not yet a prediction of the theory. To be a real prediction of the theory, we need these values to be fixed by the theory.
Okay.
This we don't have yet.
Okay, you don't have it.
We don't have it yet. Because there are quite, going from the food theory to this low energy model,
yeah.
it's a long way. So there's no a complete path for the moment. There's like steps in this direction and steps in that direction. But because
so, all right, so that's just an indirect way that you hope to be able to detect.
Yes, indirectly.
A few years ago, I heard Fotini do something like this, and she was talking about looking at light from quasars. And she made it sound like there was a test that was going to be done fairly soon by a satellite probe or something like that. Has that happened, or is that soon?
Well, Gravity Probe B should be able to see. Well, but I think it's this kind of test which she had. How many years that?
When we get back to the rec center.
So it could have been before this. You see, because this is
quite. I think was it GLASS or something like that? The test GLASS or something like that. They were looking at quasars.
Mm. Well, quasars won, because quasars are. There's little controversy, people. So let's assume there's no controversy. But, so quasars are the farthest away objects that we know. So that, of course, even if your energy is not very high, if you kick your starter board is hard, if you make it travel for long enough, sooner or later it will hit some of the bumps in your astral arc. So you might hope to be able to see that. Okay. So the longer the distance traveled, the more hopes to actually see effects coming from this discrete structure at the microscopic level.
But nothing's come from that yet.
No.
Okay.
I was
going to
say,
yeah.
Ask you
know,
if you're not at the source, you're looking at the reception of the cosmic rays. How do you know that space has done the rippling and done the source?
Oh, you know. The thing you do usually when this is called, this can be think as modern feeling effect. What you do is that you have some data. You might take both ways. So you might assume that it's done by space-time, build up a model that will describe this deviation and see if it fits with your data. And then you went to the other way around. You might try to assume space-time is flat, smooth as usual, but that the source was somewhat weird. And try to use the understanding you have of these sources to make up a model that would predict these deviations, and then you fit it. And then it's up to either the kind of fit that you're doing or to your taste to choose between the two. But that's always true. That's always true.
I was going to ask, if similar to quasars, is there anything else that can be used gravitational lensing? Is there anything else that is on the books to test through?
Yeah, again, look up and see what else we have. There's a very few ideas which are more or less like these. Really, any kind of high energy source in a big sky can be considered. Then it's a matter of trying to realize what kind of energies these sources will be there and how can you actually measure and detect the particles coming from that source.
You're looking for a source that's inherently constant, right?
Pardon me?
You're looking for a source that's constant?
Basically, what I'm looking for is a very high energy particle.
Yeah.
So I don't think the people that do these really care about whether the source is constant or not. It's hard for me to tell if that would be important.
I'm trying to imagine the discrete volume of space, and I've been thinking of an analogy, and I'm wondering if you can tell me if this is a good one or not. I'm thinking of blowing up a balloon, putting more quantums of volume into that space. And originally I was thinking, that's not discrete, that's continuous, you can put more or less air in the balloon, until I thought, yeah, well, at some point you're blowing individual molecules in. It's like, would an individual air molecule be like a quantum of volume, and could I see the growth of the balloon?
Well, let me put it this way, if instead of measuring the volume, because of course the volume doesn't really depend on the molecules of air you have in, but let's assume we were measuring something that is more related to the molecules we have in, such as, I don't know, the pressure or the temperature of the inside, then this analogy makes more sense, because you're adding more quanta to your final result, which is like saying that on that graph, you're actually increasing the surface you're considering, so you get new nodes of the graph to be inside, but not by changing the nodes, but by changing the labels in that graph. So either these two processes, adding more nodes or changing the labels, could be the equivalent of your blowing.
Okay.
But it's really more like the idea of the photons. You put more photons, you get much more intense emission wavelength.
We got that Hamiltonian operator acting on these systems. Like, what does that look like? Like, what's a Hamiltonian?
You don't want to see.
Yeah.
Well, the technical answer is interesting. That Hamiltonian is zero. That's a technical answer, okay? Why? Because I'm sure you've seen Einstein's equations. So Einstein's equations are G equals P, okay? Well, these equations are basically nothing else than E equals zero. Because P is the energy momentum tensor of matter, okay? So the amount of energy that comes from all the matter that you have in your universe. G is the curvature of the universe. So it's the energy reply of the universe to the matter content. You put matter, the universe bends, okay? And you can actually read this equation as just saying that the total amount of energy, the negative energy coming from the curvature of space-time and the positive energy coming from the content, matter content of the universe has to be zero, okay? And actually, this should not be too technical. This has to do, more technically, this has to do with the fact that usually to define the energy of your system, you need time to be a well-defined quantity, okay? Now, what happens in general relativity, as I was telling you before, is that time is not a well-defined quantity. Time can mix up with all the other spatial coordinates. So there's no real well-defined choice of time in general, unless you go for a particular case. And because of this, there's no particular meaning of the Hamiltonian in general. And now this has a very interesting consequence. You know the Schrödinger equation. Well, if the Hamiltonian is zero, If the Hamiltonian is zero, then the Schrödinger equation reads that the derivative with respect to time of your wave function is zero. So your wave function does not depend on time. Does this make sense? It does, because that time is not a physical time. It's just a pure parameter, something that they can mix up with the other spatial coordinates. So there's no physics in the dependence of the wave function with respect to time as a parameter in general relativity. This is very, very different from all the rest of theoretical physics. Very different from quantum field theory, very different from quantum mechanics, and any classical theory. Okay? So the Hamiltonian is really the tricky, well, it's not the tricky part, but it's one object that really has in itself all the subtleties of general relativity.
Just a question regarding the quantization of space. I'm just not sure if there is some connection between, a direct connection between the quantization of length, area, and volume. Is there an interdependence? Or is it an independent kind of thing? Am I thinking in Euclidean terms?
Well, there are.
Think of it
in Euclidean terms. No? So, in Euclidean space-time, you have your object of which you want to know areas and volumes.
Yes.
Well, of course, in principle, you might expect some relation. No?
Yes.
So, for instance, if you know all the tetrahedron we had before, if you know all the edge length, you know automatically the volume, in principle. Okay. So, if the theory was classical, this kind of relation would apply. Okay. There's a minimal number of information that you need, 6 in the case of the tetrahedron, and then you know everything else, a general story. But because the theory is quantum, this is not necessarily the case. It could happen that once you know something, you lose information about anything else and you cannot reconstruct it, so that you might not be able to measure at the same time all those quantities in an exact way. So what happens is that depending on the object you're looking at, you could have this kind of incompatibility and playing a role between length and areas and volumes.
And is that the reason why you have separate graphs for quantum area and quantum volume?
We don't have separate graphs. The graph is all the same. The thing is that on the graph, the thing that contributes, so the graph is just the same. But then what contributes to volume is just the nodes of the graph. So if you have just a loop, with no nodes, that thing has no volume, okay? Whereas the thing that contributes to surfaces, if you have a bunch of photons, the wavelength is going to contribute to the intensity of light, and their spins, the way the spin is going to contribute to the angular momentum carried by light. It's like carries angular momentum as well. So it's like saying that you have the same quantum object that carries more, not just one information, it carries more. And so you can reconstruct more quantities of it. So that graph carries more information.
What intrinsic property of matter gives rise to that? What intrinsic property of matter gives rise to that?
Well, according to Einstein, it's actually energy. So it doesn't even have to be matter as we consider matter as the particles that made us, it could be just light. So it's really this that is contributing to curvature, the fact that you want the energy content of the universe to be zero. So if you have energy, you want the space to curve to respond to your energy in order to keep this equality. So before that, gravity was really thought to affect only massive objects. So in Newton's theory, gravity is described by this equation. You have no mass, you have no force. But in Einstein's theory, which is described by this equation, everything with some energy would make space-time bend and react to it. In fact, the first confirmation of Einstein's theory was the light bending in 1917, giving a solar eclipse by so.
Okay, well, looks like there are no further questions for the moment. So we'd like to invite Simone to join us for lunch and finish exactly the 12 o'clock so that we're doing the planning. So I'd like to thank Simone for a